Friday, 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. It's Councillor for Henbury and leader of the Conservative group on Bristol City Council, Mark Weston. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, a new play opens in London, Truth, Lies and Diana. And a new book's out too, Princess Diana, the shocking truth about her murder. On the August 1997 assassination that refuses to go away, we hear from author of the book, John Morgan. And as the date and venue of this year's annual Bilderberg Conference is confirmed, which was chaired for the first 20 years by a former SS officer and controls most of the arms, money and media in the Western world, we take a good hard look at Bristol's elite merchant venturers. How much they're worth, we've not been told. But over the last decade, they've expanded their influence, particularly into schools and hospitals. So where exactly are they? And are they right people to be deciding how our taxes are spent? And as Prince Abdullah of Saudi Arabia dies, the BBC release a brilliant 2.25-hour documentary about the US special relationship with Saudi Arabia. But it won't be shown on British television. It's out on the iPlayer only. Adam Curtis' latest film, Bitter Lake, looks too at Afghanistan and how Saudi Arabia and the US have fuelled the rise of Wahhabism and extremist versions of Islam we see today. Plus, it's Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 2 degrees Celsius, showers, some wintry. This weekend, highs of 5 Celsius, sunny spells, windy and some showers, also possibly wintry ones. Next week, highs of 5, sunny spells and some showers, also again, possibly wintry, little bits of sleet. Next weekend, 7th and 8th of February, highs of 7 Celsius, sunshine and showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is Councillor for Henbury and leader of the Conservative group on Bristol City Council, Mark Weston. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Evening. Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about your time you've spent in politics. So now you're the leader of the Conservative group. How long have you actually been a councillor?
First elected in 2006, re-elected in, obviously, 2010, 2014.
Okay, and tell us what your jobs are or your background is, your day job, because you can't be doing a councillor job the whole time, I imagine.
No, I'm not. Well, obviously, most councillors aren't. They do have day jobs themselves. Before I got into politics, I worked for BT and then worked for Bristol and West Mortgages, and now I'm actually in politics full-time because I work for a member of the European Parliament.
Oh, okay. What were you doing at BT?
I was in their broadband billing team.
Oh, great.
Exciting stuff. Real highbrow.
So why the Conservative Party and not one of the other parties when you decided to get involved in politics?
Because I believe in individual responsibility. And I believe that, you can't keep relying on the state and the government to provide every answer, provide everything. You have to work for it yourself. And that ethos is best echoed in the Conservatives.
But what about things like the elderly people? What about disabled people? What about mentally ill? Because this is one of the characteristics of the Conservatives in this last government, is we've seen all those groups actually up against the wall, some of them. I mean, particularly the whole social care sector. There was a question in the Parliament about that this week. So it's not fair to say, is it, that it's down to the individual, because what if the individual simply can't cope?
Well, that's where the state does come in to try and help, and I think the state has a responsibility to care for those most in need. But the problem with this all comes down to is we want the best kind of government that we can afford, and the sad part of it is money doesn't grow on trees, so you have to try and balance the needs of the society and the needs of the economy. And no one ever comes into politics wanting to make cuts and wanting to make tough decisions, and it is darn hard. But the problem is you have to balance the books. I mean, every major party now agrees to that. Labour signed up to it just a couple of weeks ago.
Are you saying the rich can't afford to pay their tax for the poor then?
See, it's a tricky question. The rich obviously can afford to pay their tax,
but they don't want to.
Well, no one ever wants to pay tax, do they? Let's be honest about it. But the problem for
well,
it
I
is
think, I hang, think
hang on,
there.
Let me
no, no,
let me
I
let me come in
because
on this.
I think
me...
quite a lot of wealthy people are
hang
happy
on, you
to
want
pay
me to
tax.
Answer the question?
Yeah,
I'm assuming
quite a lot of wealthy people are happy to pay their tax. Surely,
you happy
if it's
to
going
the question?
To the right place?
You happy for answer the question? Yeah. Okay. Right. Look at the tax rate. Yeah, when it was 50%, Labour shoved it up to 50%, and despite being in government for 12 years and 11 months, they then made tax rate 50%, and the number of millionaires in this country paying tax went from 16,000 to 7,000. Because these aren't like you and me. They can move. They have clever accountants. They can go to Monte Carlo. They can go to San Marino. They can go wherever they want.
The Channel Islands.
They can go to the Channel Islands. But that's where it is. You want to tax them just enough so they carry on, stay around, and pay those increased taxes. I mean, now, the same number of millionaires are now paying a greater rate of tax. But you've got to have it just right. You've got to pitch it.
But, I mean, you paint a picture of Britain like some kind of tax haven, like the Cayman Islands, where people want to go because the tax rates are so low.
And also, I imagine, because it's gorgeous sun and there's a lot of beaches.
Yeah, but, I mean, surely that's not the kind of country we want, a tax haven-style country.
No, it isn't. But you've got to face the reality that you want to tax people just to the point that they don't try and avoid it, evade it, or move. And this is what I think you need a fair tax rate.
Okay, give us an idea of some of the things that have been coming up at the City Council. We've seen a lot of in the news this week, for example, about the arena. What's your view on that? Because it looks as if we could be saddled with debt for decades with the arena. And I'm not, personally convinced this is something which is going to be, that useful for a lot of people in the city.
You see, I do want an arena. I think it's an embarrassment for the city that we're only major city without an arena. And so I do think it's a good thing. But I'm not at arena at any cost. I think that at the moment the finances do stack up. What my fear, though, is with any local government project, any real government project, things always overrun. And there's only... And what I don't want is for us to get in so deep that we can't pull out, and yet costs are escalating. So there's going to have to be a hell of a lot of scrutiny on it just to make sure it stays tight to its budget. But as long as it does, I think it will be an asset to the city. Although I will say this, I am still very surprised that the mayor hasn't provided any kind of parking for it. Because my fear is the communities around there are going to get swamped with cars. I mean, even if they have an RPZ, another controversial thing, RPZs finish in the early evening. So if you're going to, I don't know, a concert, Bon Jovi or whatever you're going to go watch, they're going to be flooded by people from outside of Bristol coming in and trying to park everywhere. Trying to believe that everyone will take public transport is not going to work. There should be some parking.
Okay, what other things are up the agenda at City Council at the moment, Mark?
Well, obviously, you've still got the 21-hour rollout that's ticking through. You've got the budget, which will be up for debate in a couple of weeks. So that's what is the mayor going to do there? Spoke most recently yesterday to the Secretary of State for Transport on things like the Henbury Loop and rail programme kicking in. There's quite a lot. It's never a dull moment.
We were talking on here last week about the Metro bus. A lot of people concerned that actually in Bristol Green Capital year, in fact, the launch was going on whilst we were doing our show last Friday.
Yeah.
And we were saying, well, hang on a minute. They're running this right through the council small holdings and allotments. I mean, what's going on? That, just seems ridiculous.
Well, I don't agree with that. But, I mean, BRT, in an ideal world, I think the BRT money would be better spent.
Let's just be clear here. Bus Rapid Transit is the same as Metro Bus. It's now kind of transmogrified its name into something new.
Well, you find this, don't you? As soon as any kind of public project runs into trouble, they just rename it, rebrand it, and try and resell it. But the thing is, a rose by any other name is still, in this case, a wart. For me, the money would have been better spent on rail investment, because I think if we're actually going to provide any public... a meaningful public transport, we have to make sure it's not road-based. The roads are already clogged up, and I think the buses aren't going to provide the solution. I think this may help a little, but I don't agree that we need to have a connection off the M32 through prime agricultural land. I think it can go up to the Ring Road, and I'm not buying what is being proposed. I mean, we have lobbied the mayor hard on it, so the previous scheme, which had a rather large interchange and land was earmarked for a park and ride there when there are two nearby park and rides, has been scaled back, but sadly it's not yet been ditched. I hope it'll help. My fear is it might be a little bit of an elephant, elephant.
I mean, this whole idea of having a special bridge or whatever and building over this agricultural land, then to have a park and ride appear in future years, which this bus is not going to connect up to, just sounds bonkers.
Well, the thing is, there won't be a park and ride because the way that the bridge has been built, it's not going to be able to take access for a park and ride. So this is one of the things that has been scaled back. But there are park and rides nearby that could be linked to. And it will help, for example, not being funny, but in my neck of the woods, Henry and Brenchy, we've got 5,500 to 6,000 houses being built just over the border on the old Filton Airfield site and adjoining sites. And the bus rapid transit will connect into there. So it will help some. I just don't think it's going to be this transport golden bullet. It will help a little. But it's a hell of a lot of money for a little.
Before we hear from you on today's 50th anniversary of the funeral, I don't know, well, since when did we start celebrating anniversaries of state funerals, Martin Summers? But it's interesting that we've had Winston Churchill's 50 years since his funeral today.
70.
Sorry, 50? It's 50 years since his funeral in 1965. So what do you think is Churchill's legacy? He was a Conservative Prime Minister through the war, but it's interesting that at the end of World War II in 1945, the British people voted him out.
Well, I mean, his legacy speaks for itself. I mean, we could talk about, there's an awful lot to say about Churchill. I do remember, because I was a small child at the time of the funeral, and we all got a little silver medal with his head on it, which I subsequently lost, as one does with these things. I remember growing up in the 60s, and the Second World War was very much part of people's living memory. And gradually, of course, it's slipping away, a bit like the First World War. But Churchill, of course, I've got an anecdote about that. The BBC were interviewing demonstrators in Tiananmen Square when they protested against for democracy, and the BBC interviewer asked these Chinese students, many of whom could speak perfect English, what do you mean by democracy? And the protester said, well, Churchill was a great hero of yours, wasn't he? He won World War II for you, and then at the end of the war, you voted him out. And they said, yes, we did. And he said, well, that's what we mean by democracy. And of course, it was a sly dig at their own leadership in Beijing, which had liberated the country from the Japanese, etc., but was just clinging on to power.
And it's worth saying, in the run-up to World War II, the BBC had just been formed, and Lord Reith was the first Director General of the BBC. He was absolutely adamant that Churchill was never going to go on the airwaves, and kept him off the airwaves. In fact, he's on record as saying Hitler continues his marvellous marvellous something in Europe. He was a big fan, Lord Reith was, of Adolf Hitler, and so he deliberately kept Winston Churchill off the airwaves, and in fact the government had to sack the Director General Lord Reith in order to allow to start the debate about whether Britain was going to actually start a resistance to Hitler. So anyway, what are your thoughts about your great statesman from the Conservative Party from those days, Mark?
Well, the thing is, obviously I wasn't around then, although I look a lot older than I am. I'm born in 80. Churchill, I don't think you can define him as a great statesman in the Conservative Party. I think he's just a great statesman. And to be honest, I think it cuts across parties. I mean, during the World War, he worked incredibly well with Attlee, and they got on well. Churchill was very much needed for the time. They needed that bulldog, pugnacious spirit, and he embodied it. He had his flaws. I mean, we could list them, but cometh the man, cometh the hour, and he held us together. And you look at some of the alternatives to the leadership, you know, they're talking about Lord Halifax and a few of the others. Now, history may be a bit unkind to Lord Halifax, but I'm not sure he would have prosecuted the war to quite the same extent with the same determination. Now, Hitler was a great man, and I think it's good we remember him. When you were saying, should we remember state funerals, maybe it's just an opportunity to remember an important part of our past, because the problem is the further you get away from an event, further it comes out of living memory, then you do forget about it, and those that forget history are doomed to repeat it. So I do think we should try and remember these kind of heroes and these kind of achievements.
He also had a bit of possibly a hippie side to him, because his daughter Arabella Churchill was the one that started the Glastonbury Festival, for example.
I love the fact you think Churchill had a hippie side. I think Churchill's idea of a hippie side was he once wore brown socks. I don't think anyone could. The thought of Churchill with the flower power.
He was quite a bohemian, wasn't he? He was quite a bohemian. He wasn't a clean living type.
He was a Freemason too, which is okay. But I just a little anecdote.
It's amazing how quickly this conversation has gone into the conspiracy.
Well, it's not necessarily. Well, I tell you, I don't think it's necessarily. conspiracy
gossip,
because I visited Chartwell, which was his home during the war in Kent, only to find I realised that one of the very close confidants of Churchill during the war was Desmond Morton, someone we've talked about quite a lot on this programme. And Desmond Morton, Churchill's man of mystery, the former head of the Foreign Office Library, wrote a book about, fascinating character. But Churchill moved to Chartwell to be near Morton. So who's really in charge?
I went
around Churchill's study, Mark. Let me just finish. Around Churchill's study and said, and I went to the chap at the National Trust who was at, I said, was he a Freemason? Oh, no, good God, he wasn't a Freemason. Someone else weighed in as well, saying, no, he wasn't a Freemason. And I showed him a picture on the phone from the Daily Mail, Churchill's Freemason kit all being sold at auction. You know, now, he definitely was. So, anyway, what were you going to say?
I listened once to Nicholas Soames, MP, who I think is Churchill's grandson, and he was saying, because obviously he knew Churchill when he was a boy, and Churchill took him on a visit to his farm, obviously one of the tenant farmers or something, and he said, now Nicholas, listen carefully, a dog will always look up at you and a cat will always look down at you, but a pig will look you straight in the eyes. And Nicholas said, that's, remember that in politics as well.
God, I'm not sure
which way should I look, I'm not sure
Mark.
I just find it funny.
Anyway, let's get back to some local stuff. McDonald's on Fishponds Road is coming up at planning on Wednesday next week, and I spoke to some of the campaigners from Eastern, that's Claire Fowle and James Strevens, earlier this week.
My name's James Strevens.
And my name's Claire Fowle.
We're here to talk about our objection to the proposed fast food outlets on Fishponds Road, around where the Bristol Tile Centre used to be. It's a large drive-through late-hour facility. McDonald's normally appear on retail parks or in town centres. This particular one is slap bang in the middle of a residential area, close proximity to three schools. The Fishponds Road is already a very congested road, and we can see this adding to the level of congestion as traffic tries to turn in and out the site.
We understand that it's going to be heard at the planning committee next Wednesday. The planning officer currently is minded to refuse the application based largely on the traffic and highway safety concerns that James has already mentioned. There will be just a right turn coming out of the site, which will force traffic to turn a left, which will make the residential roads of Grove Road, Thingwall Park and the area that we live a rat run. Bearing in mind that we have conducted a pedestrian count that James can tell you all about, and there are a lot of children that would walk across that site. Given that we've had a few unfortunate fatalities on Fishponds Road, we're just concerned that this is quite a worrying development, and that's why we're coming together as a community to try and stop this happening.
Okay, so what's the Mayor had to say about it?
The Mayor's position is that he doesn't like the idea, but in his position of office, there's nothing he can do about it.
Whatever fast food outlet it happens to be, you know, I think that this is the thin end of a worrying wedge. If we allow it to happen in an area like Fishponds with such a close proximity to the three schools and backing onto a residential area, and we allow a drive through there, it could happen any other area of Bristol.
I'm struggling to see why this is a different type of McDonald's or fast food place than anywhere else, Claire.
It's bordering onto people's gardens. One of the reasons that the planning officer has brought up concerns is about the lack of residential amenity. I think I'd be hard pushed to find anyone in Bristol that would be willing to sit in a garden that smelt of McDonald's all day. Similarly, the light pollution problem as well. Despite the fact that this went across every single priority area in terms of litter, fly posting, antisocial behaviour, noise, traffic, highway safety, every single priority for Greater Fishponds Neighbourhood Partnership, I think they were quite reluctant really to come out initially in support of our campaign. We are in process of looking at developing a neighbourhood plan, but that takes 3 years. Until that point, we don't feel that there was a proper consultation about this, with a handful of residents directly affected getting letters about this. And I think, if anything, I'm just hoping to go to show that this is can prove what people power can do.
Well, we shall certainly see. I mean, if the decision does go against you, Claire, what can you do?
We will certainly appeal.
It surprised me how this has galvanised our community. The first public meeting that happened was in a local restaurant, which only had about 20 or 30 seats, and I think they were quite shocked when about 100 people turned up. Then we had a second meeting, and we got about 200.
I also have a petition that I've set up, which has currently gained, I think, almost 1,700 signatures, including those on paper. If you Google Say No to McDonald's and Fish Ponds, it will come straight up.
Well, there's Say No to McDonald's in Fish Ponds. Well, it's not just anywhere in Fish Ponds, Mark. This one, actually, it's on the main road, but it's actually not part of where most of the shops are. It's kind of on its own. And as we were hearing there, right next to people's homes. This is actually, I mean, I imagine what
and it's going for 24-hour licence as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, so anyway, what are your thoughts about this sort of planning application? It was a tile shop. They're trying to do a 24-hour McDonald's there.
Well, obviously, were it me, I'd be against it as well. And the thing is, it's also incredibly close to a school, and we're trying to promote healthy eating. I think it's poorly placed. I think it's going to be for too long. There is obviously an industrial park down the road, which I think already has Burger King there as is. Now, if this were in my ward, I'd be opposing it as well.
Martin?
Well, I don't know enough about the exact details, but in general, I'm opposed to corporate takeovers of local communities, so I'd be opposed to this.
Okay, but it's actually brought everyone... It's one of the things I found fascinating about this, is how many people locally have actually decided to give up their free time to organise against it.
Well, the problem is the planning law is such that as long as they're not breaking the law, you've got to find some reason, a planning reason, why they can't do it. That's the way the British system works. And I'm afraid that if there is no objection that will stand up, then it's very difficult for local people to get what they want.
I mean,
we saw in the Tesco's debacle in Stokes Croft.
I mean, I don't know the specifics on it, but I do wonder whether the 24-hour license certainly could
be
objected to. They might be able to oppose that. The neon arches, there might be ways through it. We'll just have to see. I wish them all the best of luck.
Okay, now back to Westminster this week and to Prime Minister's questions, where Ed and Dave were having a bit of a ding-dong about the NHS. The thing that bothered me about it, though, was, Martin, and maybe you can answer this when you hear it, is he didn't even ask a question. He gets his six questions, and this is just he's just sort of ranting and raving, making a few jibes at David Cameron, but there's no actual question. Have a listen.
99 days to kick out a Prime Minister who has broken all his promises on the National Health Service. And today's revelation shows once again the NHS under him is in crisis and under strain. It's a crisis of his making, on his watch, and that's why nobody will trust him with the NHS ever again.
What a contrast, Mr. Speaker. This government dealing with the unions to stop the action in the NHS. A Labour Party weaponising the NHS. Yeah. That is what everyone can see. He talks about what has happened this week. We've seen Labour casting around for a coalition with the SNP, a coalition with Sinn Féin. The first time in Britain you'd have people who want to break up Britain or bankrupt Britain. What a useless shower.
Oh dear, what a useless shower. But actually not a greatest question either, Martin, from... Well, it wasn't a question, was it?
No, there wasn't an answer because there wasn't a question. You can tell that the election's getting close because everybody is just banging on about their existing scripts, aren't they?
No, I would agree. I mean, I do... The problem I have is the NHS is a really serious issue because, you know, we need to make sure that it can provide care for... not just us, but, you know, grandchildren and so on. And but there needs to be a grown-up debate about it, but having this permanent ding-dongs just solves nothing.
Yeah, but there is in the background to all this, there are some real hard facts, Mark. One is that this week we've heard the National Health Service budget crisis as hospitals rebel against government cuts. Hospitals have carried out an unprecedented rebellion against national NHS spending plans, warning officials they can no longer guarantee safe patient care under funding proposals for this year. Objections to the NHF tariff for 2015-16 have been submitted by hospitals, but between them represent 75% of the work the health service carries out. The tariff sets the rates at which hospitals and other providers are paid for the services they provide. Proposals for this year amount to 3.8% real terms cut. Now, this is why the NHS workers themselves and managers are complaining, Mark.
Yeah, but, I mean, obviously Ed Miliband there in his thing said that he's broken every promise, and actually he hasn't. But one big one he hasn't on is we haven't cut the NHS budget. It has been protected. The problem for it is a lot of the treatments The cost of them increases at a greater rate than inflation. But the budget itself hasn't been cut. And what I found shocking is before the last election, Alistair Darling refused to commit that he would ring-fence NHS cuts, or NHS from the cuts. Whereas we have... Now, the NHS could spend more money because we all want our relatives and loved ones to have the most care and the best care that they can. But you know, obviously money doesn't come from... just grow on trees.
No, it doesn't.
But,
no.
But the budget itself
it's printed by the Central Bank,
Mario Monti, isn't it?
Yeah, well, he's having a good go at that. But the actual NHS budget itself has not been cut.
Martin.
Well, it's not being cut in nominal terms, but in real terms, it's being squeezed. I think
that is true, but when every other department virtually is facing
you'll understand
cuts.
That the Labour front bench, aspiring to be the government, don't want to make too many commitments that they feel that they can't fulfil. I think the real issue here, politically, which is what Miliband should have been pointing out, is that Prime Minister Cameron promised no top-down reorganisation of the NHS. Mm. That was one of the few things he was specific about. And I think that is the real beef here. Because I think people voted Tory, who were more centrist voters, on the understanding that the NHS basically was going to be left in its current state without being radically changed. And I think there was a plot or a plan behind the scenes to marketise aspects of the NHS. And of course, some people want to marketise it more than you.
No, that was New Labour started that. Martin.
No, I know they did. And of course, because what happens at places like the Bilderberg Conference, people like Osborne and Balls go along and be told we are going to marketise healthcare, whoever you are. And this is what people suspect goes on behind the scenes, that the current Conservative government did not say anything about top-down reorganisation of the NHS, but they had a plan to carry it through.
But Labour does the same, Martin.
It may have been exactly the same under the Labour Party.
Can I come back on this?
Yeah, but I just want to say, Labour does the same, Martin.
It does.
What they do is they'll say, we're going to do X, Y and Z, and then all of a sudden, when they got elected in 1997, all sorts of new things popped up over the horizon.
Well, what they did is they opened the door to the marketisation, which is now being...
The funny thing that I get is Labour have tied themselves in knots. Obviously, the NHS could... and should have as much money as it needs, but we have to face financial realities. Labour having a go saying it's underfunded. They then have a go that the deficit hasn't been eliminated, but then oppose any attempt to balance the budget, and themselves won't commit to, or didn't commit to, ring-fencing the NHS budget. So they've sort of tied themselves in a bit of a quandary there. I'm not quite sure how they're getting out of it. But what I would say is the NHS budget as itself now, and the privatising thing, which you raised there, it's privatised now, I think it's 5.9% of the NHS budget is in private hands. And the funny thing is, it was 4.4% under the last Labour government, which did the vast majority of it. So I wonder, are they angry that they started it, or are they angry that the rate of increase has slowed under this government?
Well, I think for people like myself on what you would call the far left of politics, I would have been opposed to any...
Should we call it the traditional left?
The traditional left, OK. I'm opposed to any kind of privatisation of the NHS. And if you remember... I don't suppose you do remember, because I wasn't alive at the time.
I probably don't remember.
Nye Bevan in the 1950s resigned from the Labour government because they brought in charges for spectacles. And a lot of his friends were saying, well, look... asking people to pay for their spectacles and not even paying the full price for their spectacles, surely that's not a resigning matter. And he said, no, it's the principle of the thing. Once you start charging people for things, that's the thin end of the wedge.
Well, maybe that's why there's so few decent people left in politics because their principles won't last 5 seconds.
Let me put this another way. Things like that we have in this country, for example, where people give blood for free, which is the way we do it, probably from the Second World War and all the things we were talking about earlier, that this is part of the way we do things. If you start buying blood, people will stop giving blood for free. So it's one or the other.
But actually, it has been privatised, the blood bank.
Well, indeed,
bank
it was privatised in the 1980s, if you remember, and they bought lots of Factor VIII from Texas and from the US healthcare industry, which was all contaminated with HIV, and lots of... haemophiliacs, including my friend in this country, got HIV from that contaminated blood supply because it was saving money by buying it from people who've given blood for money. And of course, the people who sell blood for money tend to have...
There's also a great lack of awareness of HIV at that point.
There was. Indeed, there was. But nevertheless, it was an accident waiting to
Look,
happen.
Guys, can we get back to the point?
And because about we've moved this away money from the principle of free
this
provision.
Money doesn't grow on trees thing, which you've mentioned a couple of times now, Mark. Actually, it does, if you are the European Central Bank, grow on trees. They are now talking about printing 1.5 1.1 trillion euros to start spending out into, in fact, lending out into to the various governments in the eurozone.
No, they're not giving it to the governments, it's going to the banks.
It's going to the banks, all right, in the eurozone. So that actually, I mean, I would argue, is just counterfeiting. What they're doing is they're using printing machines. They're using pressing buttons.
They're trying to combat deflation, aren't they? That's what they're
trying
to do.
If they can do it, why can't I?
Just continue to print your own currency.
Well, I mean,
you can print it, but I guarantee you the shops won't take it.
This whole business of where money actually comes from. Surely the government's got to get a handle on it, take a line, and say, right, actually, we're in charge of this, not these banks.
Well, isn't it quite funny? Because when the governments are in charge of the banks, then we have a go at them over the fact that they're politicising the monetary policy and all the rest of it. And so when they put the banks at slightly arm's length, we then have a go at them for not being fully in charge of the banks. I think you're in a catch-22.
Isn't it better that the people we elect run the money system rather than private bankers for their own private profit?
To an extent, but you've got to look at it. They're not totally given away, and you know it doesn't act totally removed. They do serve each other because you put the bank chair in charge. And I'm not sure I go quite by the way you're going on.
Okay, what I'm saying, I suppose, is that these bankers are basically printing money now in Europe. In fact, they've been doing it here
quantitative
with the pound,
easing.
QE, for years now. And of course, their own sector is doing quite nicely out of it. Their bonuses are going up and up, aren't they?
You can do it to an extent, but then you end up in sort of like a situation like the Italian lira, where, you know, it was 500 lira was 18 pence, and I think that was in 94, and then it carried on. So you can do it to a point to try and suppress your debts and try and promote growth and all the rest of it. But in the end, if you're borrowing money and you're printing it, then the markets catch up.
But that money is being spent as debt, so debt is only increasing. Martin, help us out here.
Well, I mean, the fundamental problems are the insolvency of the private financial markets, which was blindingly revealed in 2008. And across the spectrum, the policy was to intervene to prop up the existing financial structure. Now, the Austrian school economists, who are the real free marketeers, the von Mises Institute, they've always argued that printing money, quantitative easing, propping up the financial services sector is misconceived. And
Why?
Why? Because ultimately, all you're doing is you're causing what they call malinvestment. There's no proper price discovery going on. If you're a speculator, you can now borrow money at zero interest from the central banks, whether it's the Fed or the ECB now, and you can then do a carry trade into buying any kind of asset and make a quick profit. And the whole system, the stock market, has now been pumped up by this process. Now, the hope was that by pumping up the stock market, this would then start the wheels of the real economy turning. And of course, they've not reached escape velocity. And of course, the danger now is you fall back to earth with a massive bang.
The interesting thing is, I mean, I'm a historian when I went to university and all that, and I quite liked alternative history, whereby you change one small thing and you see what ramifications might have come out, and you speculate. Now we're sort of in alternative economics stroke history, because we saw what happened with the problems in Lehman's. Obviously, when that went to the wall, there was all kinds of issues. Now, if we'd have taken that, what you're advocating there, Austrian model, that you go very Darwinian, you let the banks fold. Just imagine the economic chaos that would have stemmed from there. Now, that could have been cataclysmic. So
It could still be so,
but it has bought at least time to try and shore things up.
The Argentinians went through all this around about 2000, 2001, Martin, but they've recovered.
Well, and so has Iceland, incidentally, who didn't bail their banks out.
But they didn't have a pleasant time doing it, did they?
No. The point is, you can, as you say, the purpose of bailing the banking system out is to buy time. Now, I would argue that is time where basically, if you've nationalised the banking system, which is effectively what you've done, you've then got to run it as a nationalised industry. And, of course, nobody wanted to do that because we're still we're going back to the time before the crash where we're going to have private banking again. Now, it may be, you see, that we're just out of phase. Ultimately, I think we will have a publicly run banking industry.
I mean, the interesting thing to this is obviously the bailouts bought time, is what I was saying, and you got the bailouts of countries like Greece, where we've seen the election this year. See how I've pivoted to one of the news stories we're coming
this
to
week,
later?
This week. Beautiful.
Excellent.
Week. Perfect.
You end up bailing out a country, but there is a democratic kickback, and that's what we're seeing in Greece. But it has bought time to at least shore the rest of the eurozone up.
Yes,
to an extent.
The danger is, as the Austrian economists will point out, is that what you're doing is you're pumping up an enormous bubble. And therefore, the crash, when it comes, is more catastrophic than it would have been in 2008. Now, I'm afraid that is my reading of it. We are going to have a bigger crash, and nobody in the mainstream is really talking about this. Because if you're a politician trying to get elected, you don't want to go out to people and say, you know, Churchill went through the whole 1930s saying we're going to have a war with Germany, and saying, go away, we don't want to hear that. And of course, nobody wants to face up to the fact that the financial services sector is fundamentally
Well, maybe in 70 years we'll be talking about your prediction.
Well, maybe, but I think that the danger of a crash is palpable. I mean, Mark Carney, the head of the Bank of England, was saying people shouldn't be getting too... you know, the British economy is very fragile. Mm-hmm. We've been having quantitative easing when the Eurozone hasn't. We've also, because we've got our own currency, we can devalue, mm-hmm. which nobody else can do. The Greeks can't do that.
Nope.
And the other thing...
I do wonder why they're in the Euro.
And the other thing that we're doing is we're running up massive household debts. Now, in other words, we are running up a traditional British bubble. It's rather traditional, and the danger with that is that the crash is at the end of the road.
Okay, folks, we're going to go. Mark's cued me perfectly to Syriza, and let's
just
go
for
to
you.
The House of Commons, where left-wing Labour MP Jeremy Corbyn asked the Prime Minister if he'd had a phone call with Alexis Tsipras, the new Greek Prime Minister.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I wondered if the Prime Minister has yet had a chance to place a call to Alexis Tsipras, the new Prime Minister of Greece, to congratulate him on winning the election, but also to learn from him why the people of Greece have finally said no to the imposition of the most appalling austerity, destruction of their public services, high levels of unemployment and deepening poverty. Will he use his good offices within the European Union to ensure they do get the debt write-off they're so desperately seeking in order to restore Greece to the prosperity that it deserves to enjoy?
I have had the privilege of speaking to the new Greek Prime Minister. Indeed, I asked him what his long-term economic plan was. But what I think is... What I think is absolutely key to recognise is that over the last 4 years, we've seen the British deficit come down, we've seen jobs created, the economy bigger than it was before the crash, whereas in Greece they've had repeated economic failures, and you can hardly blame them for wanting to take a different approach. I hope good sense will prevail on all sides, and as I said to the Greek Prime Minister, there are areas we can work together, not least because Britain has led the world on tax transparency, making sure companies pay the taxes that they should, something that needs to happen in Greece as well as the rest of the European Union.
Well, that's interesting that David Cameron has been talking to Tsipras. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out, because the Greeks, if they're going to drive a hard bargain, have to be fairly hard-nosed about it, which means...
caved.
Yeah, I think the danger is that on their own, it's very difficult for them to and then, of course, their supporters feel let down and so on and so forth.
I think one of the things, though, I mean, it's sort of like a game of poker. Yeah. And the big threat that Greece has got is we will leave the Eurozone and then all hell breaks loose. But he's already ruled out leaving the Eurozone.
No, but they may be forced to leave the Eurozone anyway by the markets.
They might well be. But the thing is, if you're going into negotiations, you know, the Germans obviously don't want to bail them out and they don't want to leave the Eurozone. Now... The funny thing is, if you're going to negotiations, why have you ruled out the one threat that you have to hold over your negotiator?
I mean, surely he's going into the poker game with a smile on his face, and actually, you know, he's keeping some cards close to his chest, Mark.
Interestingly enough, the first person he spoke to was the Russian ambassador when he was elected. And, of course, the possibility is that Greece could leave the Eurozone, and the Russians are already making cooing noises.
What, pegging the drachma to the ruble?
No, but no. They could certainly get support of various kinds.
But Greece today did actually back the expansion of the sanctions on Russia.
No, they didn't. Tsipras has opposed it.
No. I thought I read it earlier.
Okay, well, we can check that.
We can check that.
But look, I'll tell you what. Let's just run through some.
Let's
just run through some of the policies that they've announced in the new Greek government. First of all, action on jobs and wages. A promise of 300,000 new jobs in the private, public, and social sectors, and an increase in the minimum monthly wage. Also, debt write-off, a headline-grabbing Syriza policy that's shaken the Eurozone, promised to write off most of Greece's €319 billion debt, which is around about £240 billion. Also, scrapping of property tax, It's not just the poor who voted for Syriza, but the middle classes as well. Property owners in Athens' leafy northern suburbs were enticed with the promised abolition of a hated annual levy on private property, and also closer relations, as you were saying, Martin, with Russia.
Yeah, well, I think the issue is going to be the debt write-off. What people in Greece obviously are rightly saying is we're more in debt now after 5 years of austerity than we were at the beginning of the process. In Britain, we've got a more nuanced position. The economy isn't in the same state, but the deficit hasn't gone down as much as the government would have liked.
No.
In Greece, it's a much more stark situation.
Although the deficit has come down there,
but not
but
as
the
much,
debt has gone
not
up.
As much as, but not as much as was originally projected.
Okay.
And I would suggest that's got a lot to do with the
just,
relative
just looking,
health.
Looking online over the Russia sanctions issue, there's a story last night saying Greece was misinterpreted over Russian sanctions. Greece delays EU agreement on Russia sanctions. That's one of the most recent ones.
I think if you check EU Observer, I think there was a story this afternoon.
Okay, and most recently, Russia might bail out Greece, says the finance
well,
minister.
Bailed out Cyprus. They have form in the Mediterranean
exactly.
area.
The geopolitics of this situation start to emerge. And of course, what Cyprus is saying, we voted as Greece to let Germany off 100% of its debts in 1953, because Germany at the time
the London Agreement, yeah.
Because and therefore, you know, it's basically if we were to actually say, well, actually, we want you to pay your debts from 1953. There's a question of, and don't forget that Germany had invaded Greece, seized its national assets from the central bank, etc., etc. So these things start to come to a head at this in this kind of situation. And I think the Germans, who are the leaders of Europe, I think that we can call them that.
Definitely the Eurozone, but
yeah. But they have to actually, if they're going to be the leaders, then they have to, you know, they have to act as lenders of last resort to those who are on the periphery. Otherwise, the zone won't work.
But this—I mean—the zone doesn't work, and it's not going to work.
No,
it's a political project, not an economic one. The thing is, though, Syriza's manifesto there—the stuff you're saying—it really is motherhood and apple pie, isn't it? I mean, they're going to increase the minimum wage, they're going to guarantee jobs, they're going to cut debts, you know, scrap property tax. Apparently, money does grow on trees, at least in Greece, from what I can tell.
Well, what they're suggesting is that they should be there should be debt relief, which will then give them the possibility of the room for manoeuvre to do.
Yeah,
these
but
things.
The thing is, you've got elections coming up, particularly in Finland. Now you're going to need unanimity in the Eurozone. Now, Finland do not want to send more money to Greece.
Well, the
Dutch have also said they don't want to do it. The Germans have ruled out. I think there is going to be an almighty crunch here. I mean, the only leader I think that has backed Greece is Mario Renzi, but the Italians are in a similar situation that they actually want to
bail
out.
Well, you're going to get possibly a southern European bloc developing in that case.
Ironically, I think the euro would work better were it in two chunks, one in northern Europe and one in southern Europe.
Well, one of the solutions that was suggested a few years ago was that the Germans should go on the Deutschmark and leave the euro to everybody else.
Can we just finish on this whole business, because I think it's one of the most fascinating aspects of it. I mean, the idea that Greece might be bailed out by the Russians I find quite extraordinary. Ukraine conflict, the EU is extended sanctions against Russia, so it may not be that complete unanimity with the Greeks involved, but they have, Martin.
Well, yes, but I mean, in actual fact, sanctions have to be agreed by all member nations, so the Greeks are in a position to spike that if they wish to do.
But they've agreed it.
Well, I mean,
I think they altered the wording, but they've agreed it.
Yeah, right, but you've got other. I mean, the South Stream pipeline, which was going to come up through the Balkans, through Greece, that's been cancelled. The EU said they didn't want it. Mm. So what the Russians have said is we will have a pipeline which will go to the border of Greece and Turkey, and then we will sell our gas to Greece and Turkey. And see, the Russians are trying to bring Greece and Turkey together, because, of course, there's a great deal of history of conflict between these two countries.
I think we could describe the relations as tetchy.
Yes, but if they both...
There's some history there.
If they both have a shared project, then that might help to lower tensions of that kind.
Okay, anyway, bringing some of this back home to talk about the economic plan here in the UK, there was another question at Prime Minister's Questions about the long-term economic plan.
The Prime Minister, his Chancellor and the entire Conservative Party like to talk about their economic plan. Independent report published yesterday from a group of academics that shows that welfare cuts merely contributed to cutting tax for higher earners and contributed nothing to reducing the deficit. It also shows that families with children under the age of five have been the hardest hit. So what future is there for the country with an economic plan that steals from the poor and gives it to the rich?
Let me tell you, by the way, it's the long-term economic plan. Let me tell him how it's going in his own constituency. And never mind the academics, let's see what's happening for working people in his constituency. Right. The number of people claiming unemployment benefit, down by 31%. The youth claimant count, down by 34%. The long-term youth claimant count, down by 57% in the last year alone. Look across London and you can see 470,000 more people in work. Over 500,000 private sector jobs created. What I want to know is, when did the Labour Party become the welfare party? When did that happen? It's this side of the House standing up for hard-working people, on the side of work, on the side of enterprise, reforming work, and yes, reforming welfare to make that happen.
Shockingly, I'd agree with Cameron, but I think you suspected that I would. I mean, the economic recovery is, well, I don't want to say fragile, but it is there, and I think it is real. It can be blown, of course, particularly if Greece and the Eurozone, as we've just spoken about, blows up. But unemployment is down. The number of people in jobs is obviously up. The growth is in the economy, although it's not everywhere, but it is growing quite well.
We've had some figures this week, haven't we?
Yeah, 2.6 in the last year.
GDP slows in the final quarter, but the annual pace is fastest since 2007. There's definitely mixed messages. I'm not quite sure which. Is that good or bad?
Oh, it's obviously, it's better than if it had shrunk. So it is good. I suppose it becomes a question of how good is it? And I think one of the problems is, in any recovery, wages lag behind. And so people, I don't think, are feeling it fully yet, but it is there. It is real.
Quarterly rate now of 0.5%, Martin. Is that enough?
Well, given the wider context, we were just talking about the Eurozone, there's every possibility. You see, when we're talking about bailing out Greece, what we're really talking about is bailing out the German banking system. So the money is given to the Greek government to pay off the German banks, to keep them solvent.
Oh, not just German banks.
Well, yes, but of course, British banks too.
Yeah, so there are other banks
involved. I think the problem is for Britain in general is that because of the financial services sector being so dominant, I mean, we had Ian Fraser on the other week who's written a book about RBS. RBS's assets alone are bigger than the British economy. And that's a supposedly private institution now publicly owned. But the assets on paper are bigger than the British economy. So if there is a major crash, Britain will be at ground zero of that crash. Mm. So we will. The real danger, whoever the government was, we've now got ourselves into a very dangerous situation where we're walking on a tightrope off which we could fall, whoever the government is.
I mean, just bring it back to the question that was posed. I think Labour are tying themselves in knots. I genuinely don't know what their economic policy is. It seems to change every day. I mean, they've talked about various home taxes and all the rest of it, but they've changed what the money is going to be spent on so many times that I've lost track.
Okay, well, let's get back down to earth and look at some of the effects of all this. This is why we talk about the economy, is because the actual effect it has on the ground. A shocking story last Friday, which we missed on last Friday's programme. Cancer-stricken dad saved from bailiff's eviction when crowd of 500 strangers surrounded his house. Cancer sufferer from Nottingham declared victory over bailiffs looking to evict him after a 500-strong crowd of strangers formed a blockade around his home, forcing them to turn back. Tom Crawford, who's 63, has been fighting bailiffs in an ongoing battle over claims that he owes £43,000 in outstanding mortgage repayments. Today, 6 months after the first eviction attempt, which saw 300 strangers turn up to stop the bailiffs, they were again forced to abandon plans to expel him from his home of 27 years. Now, this is pretty shocking stuff, because if you look at the amount he's actually paid back, I mean, we don't want to go into all the figures, Mark. I mean, it certainly looks as if he's been paying this £300 to £400 in monthly mortgage repayments for decades, and he should have actually repaid the money for the house altogether. But anyway, this is I think the central point is 500 strangers turn up outside the guy's house to stop the bailiffs evicting him.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think this has anything to do with welfare, but I have to say I congratulate those 500 strangers. This seems like the bank has made a serious mistake here, and the fact that he was meant to have gone onto an endowment mortgage, and he says he was, and actually when he flagged this up, the bank had admit they made a mistake and sent him a bottle of champagne to apologise to it, and then they seem to revert back to, actually, no, we hadn't made a mistake. So I think the bank has made a tragic error here, and he's suffering for it. And I think those strangers did a good thing of shielding from it. I think the bank should actually own up to this
one. I think we've got a bit of a problem. I mean, we have Ian Fraser on talking about the GRG, which is part of the RBS, which was actually so-called helping loans for businesses. But then people would find out, actually, in the small print, there were all sorts of clauses they didn't know about, and that their assets were then taken off them. Basically, what they were doing was asset stripping. Now, what bothers me is that people like this poor chap suffering from cancer don't have the wherewithal to fight back when the banks play fast and loose with them.
Well, I would argue that once RBS has come into the public sector, but the problem is that they're being told that they've got to, that their mission statement, their task, is to make themselves fit to be put back in the private sector. Now, if they're going to do that, they've got to actually do as much as they can to get their balance sheet rebuilt so that they can then be sold off. Now, I would argue that that shouldn't be the prime goal of management of a nationalised bank. It should basically, for example, you might say that we're not going to evict anybody if they can't pay. What you could do in this case, for example, is that the government could take over the mortgage and run this, and the person pays rent to the government. Now, these kind of steps are non-market steps.
No, that won't happen, though.
No, it hasn't happened so far, because what we've done is we've tried to rewind the video. We've tried to run what is effectively a nationalised banking system as if it was going to be privatised again. And I think that's the fundamental error from my point of view. And, of course, when we have a further crash...
I think we're getting a bit away from this individual case.
No, I know, but I'm trying to build a bigger... You make a very good case that there's been a mistake by the bank here. Mm. But, of course, these 500 people turning up to resist the eviction. We've seen all sorts of things like this in Greece. Syriza has come to power on the back of a mass movement of people doing things like this. You know, setting up their own soup kitchens, trying to. There's lots of doctors have been. You know, they're creating a kind of alternative self-help society, and they're hoping to build a kind of better Greece on the back of it. And we've seen also in Detroit attempts to cut people off water who've, you know, not been able to pay their water bills have been resisted by large sections of the population. And I'm afraid that is definitely part of democracy. People should be encouraged to
do these
things.
One of the comments Mr. Crawford's made, Mark, is that he would rather die than move from his house. I mean, it's pretty awful that someone should be pushed to that those lengths. The guy's suffering from cancer.
I actually think, in a rare show of, you know, this interview unanimity, I think we probably all agree. But I mean, I don't. The thing is, obviously, we don't know the full intricacies of the case. We don't know exactly what was promised. I mean, we have two statements on either end of the poll. We have the bank saying one thing, we have him saying another. But the thing is, the bank admitted that they had made an error in 2007 and actually apologised to his family for it. And then it seems that they say they actually didn't make an error. I just find this very hard to believe.
I mean, two of the most important things to us are our home and our job. Mm. I think we most of us agree with that.
I mean,
that,
the guy's paid, by the look of it, nearly £100,000 for a £40,000 mortgage.
Well, so if the bank has already made loads of money out of him, why can't they just let him have the blasted house?
Because the banks themselves need to rebuild their balance sheets, otherwise they will go under. And I'm afraid they will go under. Mm. And I think whoever wins the election in May, and whatever concatenation of forces ends up running the country, I'm afraid we're going to be facing a very, very dire situation, which none of the mainstream politicians are seriously addressing.
Somebody
at the bank would probably be making a nice little bonus out of house.
Well, it's gone to the bailiffs now. It's no longer in the bank's domain. Yeah. They've sent it to the bailiffs.
The point is that there is a real danger. I think Mark Carney at the Bank of England knows what the real danger is. Is that the whole house of cards may come down. And I hope that the senior civil servants in the Treasury have got a plan for if this...
OK, I want to move on to talk about jobs now, because there was a fantastic, I thought it was very good, Dispatches programme on last week called Low Pay Britain. And I'm going to play a clip now, which looks at this company called ASOS, which is an online fashion company, and the company that's recruited for them called Transline. And they're based up in Grimethorpe, which was an old colliery town up in the north of England. And this is how, what they're talking about here is this magic 12-week period. What they're doing is they're hiring lots of people. They've got jobs for 12 weeks, but they're just as they start to get some rights after 12 weeks of employment, they're being sacked.
Hi, I'm Vivian, your stylist.
Hey, guys.
Hi, guys.
Yeah, I just
Britain's biggest online fashion retailer, ASOS.com, came to town. Through funky and glossy internet videos like this, it sells fashion to millions around the world. 3,000 new jobs here, even had David Cameron heading north, full of praise. So have local people moved from deep mining into high fashion? Not according to former worker Damian Banaszak. He was hired in Poland.
Most of the people were from, I think, from Romania, from Hungary. Yeah, you know, Eastern Europe.
They weren't from Barnsley then?
Not from Barnsley, no.
Now, Damien wasn't employed by ASOS, but an employment agency called Quality Course Limited, which trades as Transline Resource Group. And they're not just any agency, but Temporary Recruitment Agency of the Year. Damien believed he'd get a permanent contract after 12 weeks' work. But after 8 weeks...
You've got this conversation with some manager from Transline Group, and he's just basically telling you that your job here is done, and that's all.
So you are now unemployed.
Unemployed.
In a foreign country.
In a foreign country.
With bills to pay.
Yeah, with bills to pay.
We spoke to more than a dozen people who used to work inside the ASOS warehouse. All of them told us that Damien's experience was not unique. Other agency staff were suddenly laid off just before their 12 weeks were up. In fact, almost half of them told us it had personally happened to them.
When they start a job, agency workers don't have the same legal rights as employees in the same factory or warehouse. But they are guaranteed equal pay and working conditions once they've worked for, yes, you've guessed it, 12 weeks.
Well, that's a very sad story, isn't it? Who benefits from this? I mean, it's certainly not the Polish workers who came and Romanian workers who came to get full-time jobs in Britain. Is it the British workers who didn't have the jobs that were on offer.
Well, what I find so fascinating about this, Mark, is not only that the Prime Minister would go and visit this place as a great employer, but also that the recruitment agency won Best Recruitment Agency of the Year award. And what they're doing is basically waiting for just before the employees start to get rights and sacking them.
Yeah, I didn't see the dispatches programme, so I can't comment. The problem for it is yeah, they found, I think I said just over a dozen, but the ASOS and Transline did say that 1,300 people have been supplied with secure employment. So is the 12-week actually a probationary period? I don't know the ins and outs of each individual case. But the bit that stinks for me, well, there's two, actually. There's one whether they actually were paying the minimum wage, because it looks kind of dodgy, and I hope that's being looked at. But the second one is, why did they have to employ all these people from Eastern Europe? I mean, I know unemployment is coming down, but there are still, you know, 1.9 million people unemployed in this country. Why couldn't we find domestic workforce to fill this gap?
But I'll tell you why. It's because they're advertising over there because they think that people will work for less from Eastern Europe.
Yeah, this is one of the problems. Is why
they're finding it more difficult to recruit in Britain.
I think David Cameron is absolutely right when he says he has to renegotiate our terms of membership with the EU and then obviously having a referendum, because this kind of action is just appalling.
So is that going to happen? Is he going to successfully renegotiate?
Well, he may try. There's two hurdles he's got to cross. First of all, he's got to be re-elected. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, he's then got to deal with the fact that the free movement of labour is a core aspect of EU membership. It's not something that the other countries are prepared to compromise on, and they've already said so.
Yeah, in fairness, though, it's sort of like Cyprus again. You know, they've got tough negotiations to come, and so everyone has taken their stances. Mm-hmm. You are right. If Cameron's not elected, there will be no referendum. But if he is elected, then we'll be renegotiation and referendum. And one of the things may be that we can talk about the terms by which people can move.
Okay, final story. We've only got half a minute for it. But UKIP General Secretary has called for the NHS. I wish you'd been here. Had this story last week. For the NHS to be privatised, and compares the NHS to Nazi Germany in a speech over in the United States, Martin.
Well, the UKIP fellow who had Ed Rose on last week, I don't think he believes that. And I think that UKIP have actually got very varied views about this.
Mark.
I would agree. I don't think this is UKIP policy, although I'm happy to throw stones at UKIP, but I think this is one guy saying some very stupid things, and I imagine the vast majority of his party don't agree with
this. This is Bristol's BCFM okay, that on
was,
93.2.
Councillor for Henbury and leader of the Conservative group on Bristol City
mobile.
Council, Mark Weston. After the Murdoch news, a new play opens in London, Truth, Lies and Diana. And a new book too, The Shocking Truth About Her Murder. Plus, we look at the Merchant Venturers.
Live from the Sky News Centre.